welcome back to Going Nowhere.
Hey, how are you, friend?
Hi, I am Laura Beth, for those who haven't heard us before.
And I'm Cynthia Baca Davis.
And yeah, we're right here in the middle of nowhere.
Yep, sitting right here.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to be nowhere when, like, somewhere is so loud and everywhere.
But, you know, I was thinking the other day of nowhere, just the word.
Yeah.
And it's now here. So.
Oh. Look at us.
Look at us, right?
Yeah. If I am nowhere, then I'm now here.
Now here. Yeah. Oh,
wow. It just kind of, yeah, made, okay, I'm going to have to think now.
There's so many layers.
So many layers. Great. Well, we have an exciting conversation that we got to record the other day, and
oh yeah,
I want to jump to it, but not before I am now here with you, and we can get to go nowhere for a second. And so, how have you been? How are things?
Things are good. I'm getting ready to go back to New Orleans in a few days, and I have
everybody who's listened to an episode is completely shocked right now.
Yep. I think this is my fifth consecutive month in a row that I've been going back. But this time I have homework to do before I go.
Okay.
Because I'm doing a presentation, and I'm not used to, like, actually doing real, like, human, like, big people stuff when I'm there, like, responsible stuff.
So you're doing a presentation in New Orleans?
I am. Okay. I'm actually going with my friend / boss, and we are doing a presentation at a conference.
Oh, nice. That happens to be in New Orleans?
It just happened to. And now, okay, I mean, did we pick the conference because it was in New Orleans?
I mean, but if you got to go, you got to go.
I mean, we get a conference every year that is paid for, and we wanted to go to New Orleans together. So it just kind of, you know, when it just rolls out in front of you like that, you just take it.
You just roll with it.
Right. You just roll with it. So I've got to do my homework, and then I've got to do my talk, and then I get to play the rest of the time. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Good. So a working trip to New Orleans. That is a twist. That is a little bit of a plot twist there.
It is. I mean, I write articles there and whatnot, but, you know, to actually, like, have to see people and dress up in, like, actual clothes and interact, you know, yeah, that's going to be new. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Anything else going on?
No, I mean, that's the headlines. Okay. How about you?
Good. I'm doing okay. I am, just navigating this crazy world as a queer trans Christian and trying
full-time job.
Keep breathing and move gently through it. I've really been very socially busy, very engaged, and have some great things going on. I've been to two finale watch parties in the last.
I was really jealous of that other one, the one you told me about.
Yeah, so we did the White Lotus recently, and we did Severance not too long before that. So pretty intense costumes and everything.
I saw the pictures. It was amazing.
Yeah. I got to dress up as a Buddhist monk, which was, although my costume, we all agreed that it was kind of a little bit Buddhist monk, a little bit Jesus, and a little bit Jedi Padawan.
It was giving a bit of Jedi. It really was. It,
yeah. And I'm not sad about that. Yeah, I wasn't trying to, like, appropriate Buddhism, because I'm here for it and I'd love studying it, but that's not me. And so I wasn't trying to like go all in. To there. So it's always nice to, when you can pretend to be something else and still at the same time become part of who you are in the midst of that.
Absolutely.
So a little Buddhist, a little Jesus, a little Jedi. I mean, I can get down. I can be here.
Yeah, I think that's a trifecta.
Yeah. Great. So, our conversation was with Derek Webb.
I can't wait for everyone to hear it. I think we don't give any more spoilers, because it was just, I mean, it was so good. And I know you said you've listened to it, what, 3-4 times? And
I've listened to the album.
The album. I thought you listened to the conversation that many times. No.
I had to listen to myself talk enough to edit it. And yeah, no, I've listened to the whole entire album.
Oh,
which is by the time y'all are hearing this, the album is out. And
you need to go listen to it three or four times.
You need to go listen to it three or four times. And in fact, with Derek's permission, we are going to spread some teasers of the
you'll get songs. To hear a little smidge of it and you stay tuned.
Instead of the usual bumpers, we're gonna start right there with an amazing track, so we'll let it roll.
You are enough. Your power is as unlimited as your imagination.
You are wise. You are not alone.
You are becoming, forever becoming. You are always becoming. Focus on the things and the people that bring you joy. Show up with your whole self. If you do not, you are withholding a gift from the world.
I'm so proud of you.
You are so brave to be authentic in a world that demands conformity. And that is your path out of suffering and into joy.
Keep breathing in and out. You are who you say. You are.
The world needs you.
You matter.
You are an embodiment of possibility.
There is nothing wrong with you.
You've done it in the past. You can do it again. Now.
You are loved.
You are loved. You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved.
You are loved. You are loved.
All right, well, welcome back. We are very, very excited. We have been excited about this conversation for a while now. We are here with an artist and musician and all-around fun person, Derek Webb.
Hi.
Great to have you. Thanks so much for carving some time out.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah.
Welcome, Derek.
Derek has I don't know if I should age you, but.
Oh, it's unavoidable.
Yeah. So it's like early 90s?
Yes.
When did Caveman call first?
Caveman started in 92.
Okay.
Which means I've been in the job I'm currently in for 33 years. My work as a singer and songwriter is now officially as old as Jesus, which is a big milestone.
Yeah, sure.
It is. Or it means you're about to be crucified.
I know.
Well,
I guess we'll get to that because it just depends on, it always depends on what people think of the new record. So
exactly. You know. Well, yeah. And, you know, knowing a little bit about your career, it wouldn't be the first time that somebody tried.
So. Many times.
Yeah, same.
I'm with a career of it.
Same. Yeah, feel ya.
Yeah.
About the same time I got into the Christian music business back
then.
Yes,
right.
So I remember that. Yeah, back in the early 90s, a different world. So we were talking as we were gathering our thoughts and grounding together. I mentioned that at least one of my three kids seriously considered a career as a bus driver as a result of the Caveman's Call song.
That's probably not the worst job to add to whatever the jobs are.
The jobs that young folks
imagine for themselves, you know, policemen, firemen.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, I mean, bus driver, absolutely.
Bus driver, yeah, it's
a sweet
right
job.
Right there. But more to the point, it really just speaks to me to capture the power of your songwriting and just how relatable and relevant and
that's what you say
and is and how culturally relevant you have kept yourself, and even at some cost.
As
an artist, those things aren't cheap.
Yeah. Well, as you both know, I know both of you to be doing nuanced work in worlds that don't appreciate or value nuance. Yeah. And it's very easy to be misunderstood and to have to immediately, you spend as much time clarifying and defending as you do writing and creating in the first place. And it's exhausting, you know, after a while. And so, but I appreciate that about both of your work too.
Thank you.
You know, so it's, I mean, I'm just the kind of person who, when it comes to songs and songwriting, which has been my main medium, the only creative work I'm good at, I'm not a painter, I can't do anything else. But when it comes to like albums, I'm definitely the kind of person who would rather say like one thing 10 ways than 10 things. And so when I'm putting records out, they tend to be very like conceptual and thematic and, you know, and even that I know is really out of step with the way people, you know, even want to consume music and want to, you know, they want something quick, but like the two of you, I mean, I think it is worth resisting some of those conventions to do something that I feel has a little more value for the people who want to dig into it a little bit.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I had said right before we hit record that I was going to introduce you and then pass this off to Cynthia, and I am 100% not doing that. And
I'm going to
keep not doing that for just a second. You know, we're really focusing on this theme of peace is a path to resistance. Yes. And one of the competitors of peace in our culture right now is complexity.
Yeah.
It's just the multiple layers of things that we get whiplash from. Am I worried about this bill? Am I worried about that bill? Am I worried about the city, the state, the nation? Am I worried about the church? Am I worried about the queer community?
Yeah.
You know, where is the next threat coming from? Where is the next big thing that we are all supposed to be excited about? Which retailer am I supposed to be protesting today? Which one fixed it and now they're off the list, so I'm supposed to go shop there. I mean, it's just, it's mind-boggling.
It is.
The peace that I just felt when you used that phrase, I'd rather say one thing 10 ways than 10 different things, just to me, cut through that complexity in such a powerful way. So, I mean, as an artist, how do you rest in your soul on what the one thing is going to become?
Yeah. I would love to hear reflections from the both of you on this too. I would be fascinated to hear it because I think everyone has a different way of doing this. And I think for me, it has been always very instinctive, and I'm sure I'll hear similar things from y'all. But like for me, I've often said that the job description of a creative that I have liked anyway. And so if you're a creative person and you're listening to this and you like this, then you can have it and try it. But the one that I've liked a lot as a job description is to look at the world and describe it. That's the job. Look at the world, tell us what you see. That's it. It's as simple as that, really. But the thing about that is everything in that invitation is a variable. So the world that we are looking at is constantly changing. Who we are as we are looking at the world are constantly changing. And so everything, you can stand in the same place and look at the same thing and see something completely different. Maybe something not even worth documenting to you at this moment. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was everything to you 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 6 months ago. I mean, and so it's been interesting for me having done this job for decades, I've done this job. And that has always been my creative ethic, to look at the world and just describe it. And what I have trusted over the years is that whatever it is that comes into my view that seems important, that takes up space in my view as I'm looking at the world, is the thing I should focus on. I mean, it's not even a choice. It's just like whatever it is that seems to me, naturally speaks to what my values are and my priorities and the grid through which I'm looking at the world, which speaks to my beliefs or my assumptions about invisible reality and things like that, spirituality, whatever you want to call that. It speaks to all that. It speaks to my life experience. It speaks to, when I look at the world, what is it that I notice? What do I notice? What seems like it's worth my time to document? And not everything is. And for most of the time, nothing is, honestly, because I'm not a prolific artist or writer. I'm not like some of my friends where they're just like professional autobiographers and they're constantly writing songs every day and just journaling like that. That's not how I do it. I'm lucky to get, you know, 10 or 12 songs every couple of years to be able to put a record out. and I record everything I write. I don't have any extra ever. And so it's like, it's for me, that's really how it is. Like I'm
interesting.
And so something has to really come into view for me and be extremely important for me to start writing, for my body to respond to it and to start putting aside all the other urgency of life and start to sit down and carve time to do it. And that's always how it's been for me. And I've always trusted that. And so, and for people who might be familiar, like one of your kids there, with like the early Cademan's music.
Okay. For the record, the only reason my kids were listening to it is because I was listening.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. But you know, for people who go back that far with me, and that's crazy that it's possible. And there are some folks who do, believe it or not, up to folks who at any point you've resonated with, if we've crossed paths and we've connected and somebody's resonated, but maybe they don't anymore. Mm-hmm. Cause I have a lot more people who don't anymore. I have a lot more people who have liked what I have done and no longer do at any given time than I have people who actively do currently, like just because life is long, you know, and I've been doing it for a long time. But the thing I always tell people is like, hey, like it's okay if you don't resonate with this or if you don't, because I am, but I want you to at least trust that I'm doing exactly the same thing that I was doing when I produced the stuff that you did resonate with and connect with. I'm still doing, so maybe our stories were resonant for a few years and then we split at some point. I had a life experience that changed my story in a way that yours wasn't. And it's okay if you don't resonate with it. You know, what I write is for hardly anybody. Like my music's not for everybody. It's almost nobody. But the few people it's for, it's really for.
It's really, yep.
And that's absolutely what makes it worth doing for me. And I'm suspicious that's exactly, and I know from both of your work that I think you would say exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, in publishing, they will tell you that if you're pitching a story, to not approach editors with, my book is for everybody. Because if it's for everybody, it's for nobody.
That's right. Nobody's going to grab it.
And there's no target. There's no, like, where do we aim, though? Where do you aim to hit everybody? You know.
Right.
You can't. You can't.
Exactly.
So. And it's not going to have that meaning where if you're writing for the small niche group, they are the ones that need that. And that is so much more valuable than this generic thing that could appeal to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if it can scale, it will really only scale from there. It will scale, and sustainable scalability when it comes to art and journalism and whatever else really only comes from it deeply connecting and rooting in a small area and then blossoming and growing from that small area, if it's sustainable. Otherwise, it's just like a little bit of weed growth on the top for as far as the eye can see, but it's gone in a couple of days.
Easily washed away. Yeah.
That's right. What you want is for something to deeply root and then grow and as a result of the folks who it has deeply connected with. And then those folks share it with other folks who have those things in common, and it spreads slowly, but sustainably. And so that's what I've always aimed for, you know?
Yeah. And it is interesting. So many thoughts. It is interesting how people that may have resonated with you then didn't for a few projects, then might.
Yes, that's right.
Because it all come, I mean, journeys are an ebb and flow. And
I've been so grateful when I've heard that from people where folks said to me, like, I was into your music a long time ago. And then usually the common story I hear nowadays is I went through at some point, some kind of maybe a spiritual, I mean, the term that a lot of people might know is like deconstruction, which I think is not mm-hmm. a helpful term just because everybody has a different definition for it. And if we can't, we should really be careful with our language and make sure we are agreeing to terms that we understand, but you know, like an audit of all of your presumptions about invisible, unknowable things, God in the future. And so they went through such a season and then kind of left me or Cademan's or whatever back in that season. And then later somehow came back around to realizing that I had gone through a similar season and maybe there was soundtrack for them that did resonate again because of where we came parallel again. And that's always so sweet when I'm like, oh, I love being refound by somebody. It's like,
Well, I mean, so I did this, with Rob Bell.
Yeah, sure.
I read several of his books and I panned them. I was like, this guy's off his rocker.
Ah.
Then I came out. I went through my own audit, deconstruction, reframing, I like to say.
Suddenly, Rob Bell is right back in.
And I went back and read those books. I was like, Oh, I literally wrote him an apology.
Oh,
you didn't know that I was panning your books because I don't matter. But I was, and I'm really sorry about it. And I really appreciate where the work is now.
Yeah. You know, Oh my God. Yeah.
Pete Enns was another one of those that was like that. They were three steps ahead of me in the process.
Interesting. Yes.
And it just takes time to catch up.
Yes. And records I have loved over the years are exactly the same way. I mean, yeah. Some of my favorite records are ones that I can think of are the ones that when I first heard, I did not get and was maybe even really angry. Because they had so clearly progressed so far beyond where I was and was willing to go at that time. And it wasn't until I progressed a little bit and grew a little bit and then came back to them, just exactly as you said, with kind of new eyes, new ears. And then it's like, did I even hear this before? Because now I'm listening to it and I can't imagine not deeply resonating in the way that I am in this moment. How did I miss it? In fact, not even miss it. How did I listen and so actively not connect with this? And it gives you kind of a metric of growth. You're like, oh, wow. So I have pivoted somewhere because now I'm right here ready for this. And that's a sweet thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. I love who are you writing to and who are you not writing for everybody. You know, my actual writing, my blogging, the books that I'm working on, the book that I did, specific audiences, but broader audiences.
Yeah.
I wrote the book for my mom and then realized I was writing for everyone like my mom.
Wow.
So that's to help understand this journey that I was on. The music that I do write and record, it's mostly for me. It really is just an audience of me. And I'm happy about it. And so it's out there. And if somebody else is happy about it, we'll probably be friends. I mean, honestly, exactly.
Connect with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's that whole spectrum that we get to create for, and it is still good, creative, wonderful, worthwhile work.
Yes. And the there's no wrong motivation, no wrong way to
exactly. Yeah. And yeah. No wrong emotion.
That's right.
So as I heard you talking through that process, talking through the audience, talking through observe the world and tell us about it, is there an emotion that catches you stronger in that creative space? You know, and I think about the artists that I've worked with over the years and the artists that I've had the privilege of writing with and learning from. And, you know, some of them were angry.
Yeah.
And they couldn't really write if they weren't angry or bothered. Or, you know, trying to fix them. Some of them, they saw joy in a squished fly. I mean, it was just like, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah.
I didn't get it all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was so, I'm just curious, is there an emotion that is attached to that observation that you find is the most inspiring for you?
Yes.
And is it different by project? Is it different by project?
Yeah, right.
Where does emotion fit into the creative process?
Right.
There's the question. I knew there was a question in there somewhere.
No, I love it. I think it surely, emotion in general surely plays a huge role because it's the thing that draws your eye when you're looking at your world and trying to figure out what to say about it. The emotion is like the siren on top of something that you go to and you're like, oh, that clearly. And you don't always know why you're going right to that, but it's clearly because it is stirring some particular emotion. What I'll confess to you is that as a younger person, and definitely back in my Cadence Call days, because I was like, you know, I was like right out of high school. I was in my early 20s, you know.
We're still younger people, Derek.
Thank you for that. Yes, yeah. We are. But when I was in my early 20s and writing a lot of that.
Cynthia's older than we are, but we are still younger.
Oh, I don't know. I think I may be the oldest, I'm short, so I look young, but like I'm like the Bilbo Baggins of indie. like a freakish, long, weird career. But anyways, when I was younger, what I'll tell you is that the predominant, and I'm sure this is true of a lot, especially of young males, is that my predominant emotion was anger. It was mm-hmm. anger and it was outrage. And it was like, that's what drew my eye. That's what, And even sorrow, I learned over many, many years, mm-hmm. came out of me like anger, because anger was an easier emotion for me to feel and process and utilize.
Yeah.
Sorrow was much more complex for me. Mm-hmm. And so anger was simpler for me.
Anger, from what I understand, is it's a secondary emotion. It is, but I mean, it's a go-to, but there's always something else underneath it.
Yes, yes.
Anger's what comes out first, but it's not.
Yes,
it's not the anger. It is it's rarely the symptom of what else. Yeah,
it's not the motivating emotion.
It's rarely the core emotion. It's usually a symptom, more symptomatic or layered. And for me, it took me a long time. I mean, it took me a long time and a lot of life experience and a lot of good therapy and just a lot of living and processing over a long time to come to terms with that part of my energy and to find healthy ways to process that and to get more in touch with what was beneath all that, which really was sorrow, which was always a hard thing for me to, which honestly goes back, it's relevant to the conversation we're having because it goes back to conventional societal binaries, which are obviously bullshit, you know, completely. They're invented, they're made up, they're not remotely realistic.
They create comfort zones.
Yes, they do. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I just like that vulnerability was really, apparently was terrifying for me and to show my sorrow and that was too vulnerable of an emotion for me to lead from. And I didn't for a super long time, for longer than I should have. It took me a lot longer than it should have to come to terms with that. But once I did and I found my way to sorrow as the primary motivating emotion, it did something really interesting. And I'm going to tell you, and this is interesting. These are things I've thought about before, but maybe never come at exactly the way we're coming at it in this conversation. Mm-hmm. But for many years, the songs that I was writing and the way what I was responding to in my immediate world and therefore describing and making music about tended to be for me things that were either processing my way through complex emotional situations, which is where a lot of songwriting, or it was a lot of anger. It was like, I'm angry about this. And so I'm going to, and this makes me angry. And so it was more like, wanting to fight for things and fight for people. I mean, it wasn't, the intention of it wasn't even always bad. But what happened was, let's say 10 years ago, I mean, I'm 50 now, like 10 years ago, maybe, or maybe a little more than 10 years ago, when I started to break through some of this, was when I discovered something really amazing and it changed my whole creative life. And that was, once I broke through to the sorrow and started to speak out of that and have that be what was really motivating some of the art, this would have been around the first album after this happened would have been, it was a few years into it. I didn't know how to describe the world I was looking at for a long time because the grid through which I was looking at the world had been dismantled. And so I didn't know how to just describe the world because I had no protection between me and there was no grid. There was no view that I was looking through. Spiritually, beliefs wise, otherwise. And, but once I started doing it, the response to the work was different immediately. People, when they were responding, Fingers Crossed came out in 2017. That would have been the first record a few years into this evolution for me that I'd made. People's response to that record, and it was a lot about kind of my, what I'll feel okay here calling my spiritual deconstruction or whatever. And going through some really hard personal things, you know, the breakup of a marriage. And I mean, it was a lot of hard things on that record. And people's response tended to be less about, here's what I thought about these lyrics or these sounds on this album. It was people telling their stories in response. And here's when I went through something like this and how it made me feel. And it was, I had unintentionally invited people to tell their stories because of the way I was telling mine.
Yeah.
And the vulnerability that I didn't realize I was offering. And I was doing it out of emotional desperation. I was doing it because I was really going through and feeling all that right then.
Yeah.
And so what I realized was, and I swear I'm coming around now. I'm going around third base right now. And we're almost there.
I love it.
But what I realized was that for years, for decades, all the way back to Cadence Call times, a lot of people had, for instance, thanked me. And Laura Beth, and probably Cynthia too, will be familiar with this language, but a lot of people had over those years thanked me for my ministry, for the ministry that I was doing. I'd heard a lot of that over the years. People, and you don't want to, you know, correct someone on the nuance of their compliment when they're trying to express
right.
to you
about
what you've done.
Exactly. You say things.
I mean, what else do we call this?
Yes. And so for me, though, during those years, I felt incongruent because I wasn't showing up to do my job every day in order to win people to my way of thinking. It wasn't a Trojan horse I was building. I was not, ministry was not my motivation. I wasn't getting up every day to communicate my beliefs and try to get people to believe my beliefs. That was not my motivation. I was doing it for the intrinsic value of doing it. I was doing it to express myself. I was doing it because I think art has intrinsic value. And then secondarily sometimes, like it might affect somebody in a certain way and maybe get some thinking and chewing on a thing. That's fine. It's not why I was doing it. The point I'm making is all those years, I never considered what I was doing ministry. That was not, I did not consider myself a vocational minister. I did not consider my work vocational ministry. That's a different set of gifts. That's a different set of motivations. And I have friends who do it for those reasons. And it's different than the reasons, the ways that I do it. What's interesting is around 10 years ago, when I started to hear those responses and feel that and realize, something about the way I'm doing this now on the other side of this kind of emotional breakthrough that I've had just in my own personal life, it's causing people, maybe it's helping people to feel less alone in the experience of their lives because they're relating in some way to the vulnerability that I'm offering. And once I realized that that was possible, and I had remarkably in 20 years not ever felt that in this work, such personal work, I never felt it. Once I started feeling that and intuiting that as the response, immediately I was like, this is why, if art must have a purpose, if it needs to have a function, which I don't believe that it does to have value, but if it needs to have a function, be a tool with which for, you know, to do something, this feels like its highest value that I can consider is like, if what I can make can help people to feel less alone in their lives and experiences, that is the most tremendous value I can imagine. It's crazy. It took me 20 years to feel that for the first time. And since I have felt that, it's the only thing I want to feel when it comes to the work I'm making and the reason that I'm doing it, in order for people to feel less alone in their lives. And so now, ironically, on the other side of no longer identifying as a evangelical Christian or whatever it may be, whatever the deconstruction part of it is, for the last 10 years, I have absolutely considered my work vocational ministry. it is the motivation. I think about people. I think about what language might be helpful for them to navigate through and feel less alone in an experience like I'm having now. I think about those people. And I write for that reason. And it's just fascinating that that's happening.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just saying, a phrase that I've used before kind of to describe what you're describing, what you're talking about right now, is that authentic creativity is an invitation to build.
Mm-hmm.
And so people felt free to build upon your story by adding their story to the narrative, whereas so much of our creative work and our artistic work is an invitation to admire or look what I just did. Look what how that could, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, I'm not panning that. It just serves a different purpose.
It does.
And I think that distinction between creativity for the sake of glory and glorification and admiration is not ministry. Well, no matter what we label it, but when we are creating,
when we are labeling it ministry, and we're
especially when we're doing it, but a creativity and a creative endeavor for the as an invitation to build from a place of authenticity.
Yeah.
That becomes a ministerial effort, whether we want it to or not, even if we don't try and label, even if we try to not label it that way.
It ministers to people. It does.
It does. Yeah. And it ministers to people because to bring it right back down to our conversation, to our theme here, there is a peace in community. There is peace that comes from knowing that others are on this path and others are in this space and that we can chase that. Okay. After 27 minutes and 33 seconds, I'm going to pass it to Cynthia.
What's funny
that was,
it's like you asked me one question and then 45 minutes later.
No. Yeah. And in all fairness, I I jumped right in and asked you more questions.
No, I love it.
No,
it was,
we're here for.
That was a gift. That was one of the best 27 minutes and 55 seconds I've spent in a while. So thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
No, yeah. We're going, like, we are right here. We are staying right here, and we're going nowhere until we get, you know.
Until exactly.
So we're done.
Exactly.
So, I know, I think that as you were talking, Derek, like, we've been circling around so much of what your new project is embodying, I think, when you're talking about finding a very specific group of people that you want to actually minister to. And I think that that's a lot of what has come to light for you and come to the surface for you as you've been looking around and observing. Mm. And I want you to take a moment to tell people about your project and about who it's for and what you observed that made it a necessary thing for you to do.
Yeah. And maybe even tap into that as you observed it. What was the emotion that motivated this one back to that sorrow and anger? Yeah.
Thank you so much for asking. Because obviously I would love for people to know about it. And there's the new record. It's called Survival Songs. And it's interesting. Like the things I'll say about it are things that have been, if you've been paying attention, the few dozen people who pay attention to me and my career at this point, after 30 years, would know that I have had an increasing concern and care that I have tried in different ways with my work and otherwise to express for my loved ones, people in my family, and my dearest friends who are in the queer community and the trans community. And so you will have picked this up, no doubt, over the last few years if you've been paying attention. And the last record, Jesus Hypothesis, had a very strong themes of this, punctuated with the Boys Will Be Girls song and video I did with my great friend Flamie Grant, and the resulting tour that we did together, the End of Days tour, which is his own story, you know. And Cynthia did so much good writing on that and helped signal boost that for us a few years ago. But for me, here's what I can say: end of last year, 2024, beginning of 2025, I was obviously feeling a lot of feelings, as we all have been, looking at the world. And I'll tell you that I was in paralysis. I had no idea what to do or what to say about any of it. I was really wanting to work. I was wanting to contribute. I was wanting to write. I've learned that I cannot do it if I just wish to. I have to really wait for my body to kind of lock in and respond and begin. It's just a thing I have no control over, no conscious control over. And I was really frustrated, and I was really, because I was looking at the world and watching some of the most important parts of the world burn, and the fire just traveling and spreading and growing. And it was especially in communities that I deeply care about, again, because of my family, my loved ones, and my friends, my dearest friends, in the queer community, where I've increasingly spent time, especially in my vocation. And it's been like an honor to be able to be on some front lines with some of my friends and to learn so much from them about what I can do as an ally and how I can contribute, and to take their guidance and try to figure out how to do my work in light of all that. And then I didn't know what to do, though, until it did crystallize for me, probably, you know, in like February, that I was just thinking about, and Cynthia said something about this earlier. It's about really going small, going down to the smallest, most intimate and personal application of it that you can. Or Laura Beth, you talking about your mother, you know, and writing this, you know, work, especially with someone that specific in mind. And so for me, I just thought, my huge concern I have for my friends, my loved ones, if songs are what I can contribute, what is language, what is soundtrack that I could make and offer that might help that I feel like my friends and loved ones need to hear? Like what do I feel like could be valuable or helpful for me to say, language I could provide for them to hear that might help them feel less alone and might genuinely keep them alive, might keep them alive.
Right.
What could that language be? And as I started to think about that and think about the specific, you know, people I can count on a hand or two, and thought like, what do they need to hear? It just immediately, literally, and I wrote this entire album, and this is so unlike me. I've never done this in 30 years ever. Have I had this extreme, immediate body response to a prompt like that? Once it came clear to me what the motivation was and who I was looking at, why I was doing it, who I was doing it for, I wrote the entire album in a week and a half, 2 weeks. Never happened before, never ever. And then within a few other weeks, I'd recorded the whole thing. So within the span of a month, where a minute ago, I didn't know if I'd ever make another record, had no idea how to describe the world I was seeing, no idea how to do my work. Then suddenly it was a pivot. And within literally like 3.5 or 4 weeks, I had written and recorded an entire album, and that's Survival Songs. And now it comes, yeah. And now, you know, April 18th was its release date. And
we're pretending that it's already out, even though
we are living in the future right now.
Right now, yes. Yeah.
Wherever you've made us at, it either is or was.
That's right. That's exactly right. It could be 2030 right now, someone hearing this. And it, you know, it might be coming out today for you. But yeah, but that's the album. And I'm just getting it out as quickly. I've gotten it out as quickly as I possibly could. There has been this through line of urgency about this for me. And it is an emergency to me. Mm-hmm. The lives of my friends and loved ones in the queer community, there is an emergency right now. And I'm not saying it's the only emergency in the world. Of course it's not. What I'm saying is it's the one that is front of vision and mind for me in my most intimate personal relationships. It is the one is the tallest fire in my world. And therefore it is the one that I run to first. As I've talked to other friends and they have said, yes, but what about, what's happening in Palestine? What about what's happening in minority communities? What's happening? What about immigrant communities? What about, I was like, yes, yes, my God, yes. And maybe that's the next and next and next records. But what I'm telling you is for me, the tallest fire as I looked at the world was this and these people. And so this is what I can do. It's what I'm doing now. And I'm very proud of the work, and I hope it does find its way out to folks for whom it might be helpful, for sure.
I want to talk a little bit more about urgency, because it's a word that I find myself using a lot as I talk, especially about churches and dealing with building more inclusive faith communities. And it's been an important work in the last 10 years that I've been specifically engaged in that work.
Yes.
Urgent is the word, though, that keeps coming up in those conversations. Last year was the time to get it ready. Now is the time to stop thinking about it and start doing.
Yes. Whatever preparation we've all been doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it's time. It's time. As far as the creative process goes, tell me about the tension of urgency. There are those that I know in the creative world that would say urgency is the enemy of good creative work. There are those that would say urgency is the best fuel for good creative work. And so in an era, in a moment where urgency is going to be with us for the foreseeable future,
yeah,
I'm just going to name that right now. How do we embrace urgency as fuel, not fire?
Right.
And to that creative process. And how did that play out as far as you working on this project and you engaging in that?
All the complexity, you framed all that complexity really well. And that is how it feels. And you're right. Sometimes it can feel like the enemy of it. And sometimes it can feel like the primary motivator of it. And every experience I've never had two creative processes for two albums ever be remotely the same. The albums I've ever made in over a lot of years, they've all been unique. They've all been different. and felt different, and some took years. I have records that took me years to figure out and puzzle together and then figure out how to frame up and put out and that whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's one like this where it's easily my quickest one ever, and it was so quick like this. I think that for me, all I can really speak to is my most recent experience, you know, and like, and this most recent one, because I would have a different answer for every one. For this one, it was extremely helpful and motivating, and mostly for me, it was drawing it out. Like, I was obsessed for that month. I was obsessed, and my wife could like come up here and attest to this and tell you about how off into the distance I was just like staring, always poring over lines I was trying to finish. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just urgent. Like, the urgency for me wasn't just time. I know that might sound funny, but it was, the urgency was I need to get this right. Like, I need to steward mm-hmm. this in such a way. So I have this energy. I've got this energy, this sorrow, this concern, this fear, and yes, this outrage and anger and sense of defensiveness. And I've got all these emotions, but I have to get this right. Like, because we're in a moment right now where, by the time I get this done and get it out, I think I might've mentioned this to Cynthia before, but I originally, when I first came up with the title before I started writing the songs, I was like, Survival Songs is going to be the name of this project, because that's, the stakes are no lower than that. I mean, like, yeah. These, it is for survival of the people that I'm talking about, and literal survival of their lives. And when I first named it that, the first name it had was Survival Songs Volume 1. Because my first instinct was, this is going to be an ongoing creative process. Like, I'm going to get this done. I'm going to cauterize it at some point and say, okay, that's volume one. And then I'm going to keep writing and get that out quick as I can. Because we have to right now, in my opinion, the urgency of it is to be responding to the moment we're in.
Yeah.
And to bring immediate help, because the moment is changing. The moments are changing so fast. And the world... So for me, it felt really important to keep the gap as narrow as possible between the inception and documentation of it and the release of it, because I don't know what the world's going to look like in 3 more months. I have no idea.
Yeah.
There might be a whole other set of issues and language and songs that are needed. You know, what I mean?
Yeah. As soon as you said volume one, my first thought was to go the Star Wars plan and release it as volume four.
Exactly.
But then the more you talked, it was like, no, it's volume four, because volumes one, two, and three were irrelevant.
Right.
By the time I...
Way too fast to get to here.
Exactly. Yeah. So we had to start with volume four, because that's how fast it was.
Love it. But, yes.
Yeah.
Star Wars nerd, so I love that. But yeah, I mean, that's what it was, though. And it felt like it was a friend in this process for me. And it felt more to me like stewarding... And it was helping me, like, okay, I think this is good. I don't need to be precious about it. Here's one quick anecdote that I will offer, that I do think speaks directly to your question about urgency, though, is one thing I told myself was, I need to not be precious about this. I need to not care, or be precious, too precious about how I sound and, how good did I play the guitar on that, or how perfect was it, or how pristine was the performance, or whatever. I need to not care about that right now, because it's too important that this comes out quickly, and I need to just. Yeah. So what I did is I, because you've been in the music business, you know how the sausage is made when it comes to, you know, mostly when you make records as an artist, you do it on a computer, you use a digital workstation, and you record it.
Now they do. Back when we started doing this, that wasn't...
Okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's too easy to record and manipulate and edit and change and fix and tune and correct. And you can spend hours and days and months perfecting a thing. And that was going to be the enemy for me, I knew. And so I bought this great piece of gear. It's a real throwback piece of gear for me, because it's a 12-track recorder, and it's not unlike the 4-track recorders I had in high school and in junior high. I would, you know, like a little cassette 4-track where you'd record a thing and you'd listen to it and record another layer on top and listen to those two and record another layer on top.
Yeah.
And when you've done your fourth, you're done. That's all you get. So
and for the sake of some of our younger listeners, just go Google cassette. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. Don't worry about some of what I'm saying right now. Yeah. But so I got this digital 12-track recorder because I thought this will speed it up because I just won't be able to do it perfectly. I'll have to live with. And so something about this album, it does have a lot of imperfection and humanity and nuance on it. And it's the first one I've ever made, not with a computer. It's the first one I've ever made, you know, that I couldn't fix and correct. But you'll hear the urgency of it because you'll hear that I wasn't rushing, but I had priorities on the record. Yeah.
Growing up, she heard about the end times, but they never felt so close. Showing love can make you a criminal and wearing your own clothes. She got up, went to school as if it wasn't burning down. She looked at her friend, said with a smirk, "I guess we're illegal now." And what was it about her heart that scared those men so much?
Of survival songs being about literal survival and being about, like, what, you know, we talk about stakes and those are the stakes. And I think that there may be people that don't necessarily understand the truth behind this for so many reasons. They don't either for not understanding the true mental anguish right now that's being inflicted upon the LGBTQI plus community, and also maybe not even understanding that there is actual research about music and its ability to impact the brain and save lives. There are people that have definitely said that the music saved me. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the stakes.
Yeah. One thing I can tell you is that there is just research. There is data behind, for instance, when you have a queer young person having one person in their life versus someone who has no one, or having one parent, for instance, in their life versus having none, that affirms them, that listens to them, that goes with them on their journey, that abides by the names, the pronouns, all the things that parents, you know, sometimes grapple with because of ego and because of convention and because of whatever it doesn't fear and I don't know what. Having just one person can literally make the difference of turning the statistics literally upside down. Upside down.
Yeah.
It can reverse. Just having one person in your life, one authority figure or mentor character, or somebody who for you is who can look at you and love and respect and support you in those ways, to see you and support you and be with you, it changes. I mean, especially when you look at the suicide rates, which are astronomical, and especially with queer youth and most especially with trans youth, when you look at the statistics, it's crazy to me. It's remarkable to me how important it is. And I get for some people, and you know, I'm a parent, so it's like, of course, this is going to be an immediate application for me to say to my friends, to say like, I understand that if you're a parent of a queer or trans kid, I get that it might be hard for you to use a name that you did not give this child, or to use certain pronouns or things that might be odd for you in your circle of friends or the part of the country you live in or whatever. But if you realized at every point that you are making a conscious decision to withhold that and to not do that for that child, think about, is it worth, what is it that you think you're gaining? Who is injured by going ahead and pushing through whatever it takes for you to use that name, to use those pronouns, to see that kid and to support them in whatever small ways you can? Who's injured in your doing that? Where's the injury, even for yourself, in doing that? If you had front of mind at every point, this could be the difference of life or death for my child, how do you now feel about potentially just using what might feel like a nickname? How does that now feel? If at every point you're like, these are the building blocks of whether what's eventually going to topple over and mean life or death for my child. Like, if you think, because here's the thing, parents of queer kids out there, you need to think about these decisions as life or death decisions. Yes. You need to, because let me tell you that that's what they are. You must think about it this way. So, you know, be damned what your friends or your community or your church or your state or your part of the city you live in or your whatever, your fear, all that be damned. If you care about the life of your child, go and look at the statistics about this.
Yeah.
And let that inform every one of those small decisions that add up to whether or not your kid is here in 12 months from now.
And let me expand that admonition to from parents to pastors.
Yes.
To politicians.
Yes.
To practitioners of any type, medical professionals and everything. And I'm really proud of myself that I got practitioners, parents, pastors, and all of that alliteration.
Professors.
There you go. But yeah, there is an urgency to it. I've experienced this. And one of the things that I was listening to you talking, you know, so I remember through my reconstruction, reframing process, by coming around, I don't talk about coming out, I talk about coming around my trans, intersex, lesbian identity, and finding that Christian space, finding those voices that, you know, I remember the Eugene Patterson, who was the translator of the Message Bible, and his whole, you know,
Peterson,
I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you. He was becoming an affirming person, and then there was questions around it and published. And I remember the yo-yo that is like, okay, this is someone that I have respected for 30 years of my ministry life and career. And man, what would it mean for that voice to be part of that? You know, and it's why you caught my attention and having, like I said, listened to Caveman's Call with my kids in my more conservative pastor days, and that being part of our world and saying, oh, wait a second, I'm not the only one on this journey. I'm not the only one who was something and is now something different.
Yes.
And just as passionate and excited about it. And this is normal.
Yes.
This is okay and good. This is how we grow as a culture. Yes. And as a people, and in our faith, and as a church, and as a school, and as a family, and
arguably exactly what Jesus would do if any of our listeners care about that sort of thing.
The narrative. I mean, yeah, we don't even have to get too creative to see that.
No, I mean, Jesus had his reputation willingly ruined as a result of caring for, living with and loving the most marginalized people in culture.
Yeah.
That's it. And so if you wonder, my church friends, where Jesus might be right now, where are the margins where Jesus would be standing And where would the stones be thrown? In what direction?
Yeah.
Let me tell you, without a doubt, it would be in the queer community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly where Jesus would be. So
yeah.
I agree so much. And, you know, I think of you, Derek, in that black and white polka dot dress with Flamey. And, you know, we've seen those pictures all over the place.
Yeah.
And there are people. There are people that throw stones over that and don't understand. But I remember what you said to me. This was for those of you who may not have seen, this was from the Double Words. When Flamey Grant went, and there were a group of us that went also just for support. And Derek was dressed in full-on drag, really. And, you could tell it was Derek, but still, you know, the pearls and everything. And
you had to have something to clutch. So
that's right.
Exactly. At the Double Words.
Yeah.
Your explanation for that, though, of why, like, you didn't want to just be there as a figurehead of support. You wanted to be, like, on the front lines and having people throw insult at you, too. If they were going to throw insult at Flamey or anybody else that was there from the queer community, you said, no, it needs to be at me as well. And that really stood out to me. Hmm. And I think that that was very much like what Jesus would do. Jesus is going to stand with those people and not just, you know, not just tolerate them, but actually stand in the trenches alongside of them.
Yeah.
Which is what I saw you doing.
Thank you for that. And you were there too. You were there too. And it meant a lot that you were there. And it was honestly one of the great, best quotes for anybody who hasn't heard it that I've ever heard on this that just really distills it. And I put it at the very front of that Girls Will Be Boys video, a Boys Will Be Girls video. I put it there, and it was this pastor friend of mine, Stan Mitchell, who lives here in Nashville. And he said, if you are someone who considers yourself an ally and you're not being hit by the stones thrown at others, then you're not standing close enough.
You're not standing close enough. Yep.
And you know, and like I wish to be considered and the same as, and called names the same as, and I want to be wherever my friends are. I don't want you to be able to resist putting me there with them, because I am with them. And so I didn't want at the Double Words to hide out. I didn't want to be hiding out in my male convention.
Your cis heteronormative.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to be hiding out in that space. I wanted to be clearly with my friends who I was with, and wanted to be with them in every way I could be. And the only way I could do that was to make sure that no one missed who I was there with and why. And And
clear communication.
It was a sweet moment. And none of us even realized that it was going to be anything. I mean, that it was going to have any significance or whatever beyond just our going and having that experience together. Grace Baldridge, similar, was there as well, and some other folks. No, I don't think we realized it. We were doing it for us, but it was sweet the way that it did, again, help some people feel less alone. Because one of the things, Cynthia, that you and I talked about is that especially, and Laura Beth, you'll know this too, especially in the world of CCM, of Christian music, you know, I knew for a fact that Similar and Flamey were not the first queer artists who were in that room at the Double Awards, not by a long shot.
Right.
There have been for decades, in fact, queer artists who are not only in that room, but are both giving and receiving awards in that room, but feel closeted and terrified in their own lives because of the genre conventions that that they're fearful, and the companies that support keeping those binary conventions in place.
Right.
But I know from experience, I just know so many friends who've been in the Christian music world as long as I have, who people might be shocked to find out are actually queer artists and who have received awards and received awards.
Yeah.
So, no, this has happened many times. Yeah.
And it is those revelations that for me have been so uplifting and so encouraging along the way as I've navigated this space in faith communities. I'm keeping an eye on our clock, but I just want to squeeze in another opportunity for you to give some encouragement to some people out there who might be listening who aren't sure what to do next. And a fun parallel story, as you were telling the story about the urgency of getting this Survival Songs album out there. I have about an EP's album worth of material ready, and I had decided back at the election, Cynthia was there for this whole narrative, but I decided the election is like, okay, by January 30th, by inauguration, I want to have this album of songs about hope done, and I want it recorded and published. The only album that I have out there, I recorded in my basement during the pandemic with friends from seminary. And again, those were for me. And if somebody else happens to like them, that's great. I wanted these to be for somebody. I was actually doing arrangements. I never got the musicians on board. I had an engineer and maybe a studio. There wasn't the momentum in my life that could move that project to fruition.
Yeah.
So when I talk about where churches are right now, and they, you know, it's like a year ago was the time to start moving that momentum, but it doesn't mean if the momentum's not there now that the urgency is any less or that there's nothing to be done.
Right.
If you're feeling, you know, so part of the reason, part of the way I managed that was to shift my energy from that album, which maybe it'll happen someday, maybe not, to the podcasting where the momentum was already happening. And in that space. And so, you know, you obviously had momentum around your music career, around your writing process, around, you know, even knowing what directions to go and to, you know, partners to come and play with you or, you know, connections in that space. The momentum was there. What would you say to somebody listening right now that says, I'm feeling the urgency, I'm feeling the passion, but I don't have the momentum behind me?
Yeah.
Right now.
I mean, my gut is to say, like, if there's anything I would hope someone would have heard from this conversation, it is that there is no effort that is too small to be extremely significant. And because what do we say? Even just that kind word of support from that one adult in a child's life can make the difference, can turn the scales upside down when it comes to self-harm and suicide, when it comes to, and so it really is in the smallest of things where all the meaning and significance is. It's in the smallest of things.
Yeah.
And so maybe to reframe and take the pressure and the expectation off of yourself to say, but if I'm going to do something, it has to look like this or it has to be like this, or I'd imagine it would have to be like this. And maybe, like you said, like, no, sometimes you have to say, well, but what can I do now? And let me tell you what you can do now and what you need no momentum to do. And that is to go to your friends and your loved ones and the people in your immediate community and circle and tell them consistently that they are loved and have value and that they are precisely who they need to and are supposed to be, and that they are supported and that you have their back. And even if you're just an ally, to be vocal, to use your voice in whatever small ways you can, even if it's just a text or a phone call or a social media post or or showing up at a peaceful protest somewhere, to be part of a larger number. But I think that, like, not overlooking those really small and intimate opportunities to do it, I think, because as we said before, if it's going to have scalable significance, value, and meaning, it's going to have to start really, really small. And I think go to your friends and just make sure that they know that you are there. Make sure that they know that you are thinking of them, you are aware of them, that you and whatever you can do to be of support to them, that you are there ready to lock arms with them and that they are not alone. And that there is a cloud of witnesses around them that loves them, that supports them. And when they feel the most alone, to close their eyes and imagine those people. I mean, that, and just to be communicating that in every way that you can to every significant individual person in your life.
Yeah.
Is no small thing.
Yeah.
And you need no momentum to do it.
Yeah. Even the willingness, if you don't have those friends, step out into a new place to make new friends.
Yes. Yes.
That's a great momentum starter.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Start small and grow it.
Cynthia, do you want to bring
our wrap up question?
Our wrap up question.
Derek showed me asked this one before, but Derek, is there?
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Is there anything that we should have asked you or touched on that we did not? It's your opportunity.
That is a very sweet. It's always such a sweet question. No, really, no. I would, given the opportunity, I would love to just highlight once more for folks, if they're looking for, if they've heard this and they're like, oh, that sounds interesting or resonant, and I would like to hear those songs. The music is available. And if you're listening to this and you're not reading a transcript of it, then Derek Webb is my name, DereqWebb. Yeah. Please go to Spotify. Please go to DerekWebb.com. Socials, I'm just at Derek Webb everywhere.
Yep. If that helps, I'll be in the show notes too if you are.
There you go. There you go. Perfect. Yeah. So if that helps you find your way to this music at very least, my motivation right now is, now that I've gotten the album done and it is out, is just to help folks find it. And that's the challenge. And if you're somebody who I would also just love, and I would be so bold to ask people to share it with other people. If there are folks in your life who you think might appreciate or resonate with the songs and the language that's there, please share it. I mean, that's the hardest work. And everybody on this podcast can tell you that the most valuable thing is people passing firsthand something you've written on to someone who they know it'll deeply resonate with. And then that person passing it to another. I mean, that is how this work grows. And that's how people hear about the work that all of us are doing. And so that would be really helpful. Pass this podcast along, you know, for a long form conversation about these things.
Yeah. You'll get your check for that.
Plug. Yeah.
Great, same. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it though. I would so appreciate people just listening and sharing it.
Yeah. And you're putting together another tour of Living Room Concerts.
Yes, it's all I do nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's a tour, but it is pretty heavy schedule.
Yes,
that I saw.
A lot of shows on the books, and so please go. I mean, again, DerekWebb.com.
Yeah,
or on socials, all the tour dates are there. I would love.
Yeah,
and house shows. Yeah, that's the only way I do it. I love it. It's my favorite way to do it.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, please come. Please come.
Yeah, and if somebody sees that you're not going to be somewhere close to them, what's the way? What's your process for that? Yeah,
because I've done this for many years. I will go anywhere. I love playing. I just love the work. And so they're actually at DerekWebb.com. There is a link right at the top that says host a show. And okay. if you have a space, house shows are not always in houses. Sometimes they're maybe half the shows on the Survival Songs house show tour are actually being hosted in churches. And or in people's basements or in yoga studios or in random parking lots. I mean, literally, it's just if you have a space and you can put, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 people in a space, it's free. It's fun. It's easy. I mean, my team and I, we promote it. We sell tickets. We do the whole shebang. But you can host a show. If you have a group of people who you would love to hear these songs and you want to host a little moment to have me come and play these songs for you and your friends, go to my website, click on host a show, and we'll reach back out and we'll do it. I would love that. So yes, I love having an answer, and that's my answer.
Awesome. Yep. Sounds great.
Please do.
Well, this has been a gift. The conversation I absolutely didn't realize I needed, but also somewhere very much new that I needed. So thank you. Yeah.
It's been delightful.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Derek. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, and look forward to
do it again.
Watching it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, tracking the album, and we'll check base mid-tour maybe and see.
Yeah, the world as it is, we will continue to have plenty to discuss here. So.
Amen to that. So, awesome. Thank you. Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you, Derek.
Even the president's treating you like a bad stepdad, thinking everything that makes you different makes him look bad, and maybe there's a law, squeeze you so tight, make you hate your body, give up the fight and just die. Why don't they call it what it is? Wholesale genocide ain't right at the kids, while their own holy book says love your enemies and all the little children, let them come unto me. Meanwhile, they're so busy changing all the rules, building up the kingdom, using all the devil's tools. They forgot the way history has showed us what they did. By then they'll be green grass growing on the grave of that queer kid. Oh, queer kid, where you gonna live now? Good kid, always getting kicked out of every place. You're not safe.
One of those conversations that just stays with you for a while.
Yeah, yeah, that that has some hang time.
Yeah.
Sorry, Derek, I just compared our conversation with you to a good fart, but actually, I'm not sorry. It's okay. It's great. The best things about it are it just sticks with you, and it will just be moving on. Yeah, anything. I mean, just getting to hear some of the music. Go listen to the entire album. Where you listen to albums, he gave his website. He spelled it out for us.
He sure did.
Yeah, he did.
There's no excuses.
No excuses. Anything that stuck with you? Anything that, any quotes? Any?
Yeah, yeah. I really liked the conversation. The part of the conversation where we talked about Derek saying his work was for almost nobody. And I find that to be relatable and hopeful, because it really reinforces everything I've ever learned in any of my writing training is you're not writing to the world at large. You're just not. If you're trying to hit everyone, you're gonna miss.
Publishers don't even like that.
That, because and you should be writing to one person, really, and that one person of course is going to embody other like-minded people. But I like that idea. That is I think sage advice for creatives, and it really it just crystallizes it. Like I said, everything I've learned. And it helps me feel better that my book doesn't sell as well as I want.
Well, I've been in that spot where, when you put something creative out there that is written from the heart, from your perspective, from authenticity, you're going to find who your friends are and who your friends aren't.
Yeah. You're going to find your people that way. That's what happens. People.
And not that all of our friends have to be absolutely like-minded, and they shouldn't be. But people who are like adamantly offended or put off by those probably aren't my ride or die type folk.
Right.
And, they either really needed to hear it and missed it, or it wasn't for them.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And we can't spend our time writing for people that, we're just begging them to like us. We want to write to the people who need us.
Yeah.
And sing to the people who need us.
Yeah. Well, and that kind of does play into the quote that has been floating in my mind since we recorded this is Derek's intentionality about when he said early on in the conversation, I would rather say one thing in 10 different ways on a project than to attempt to say 10 different things.
10 things is too many.
It's too many. It's too complex. And in a world of complexity in... a world that's everywhere, all of the somewheres, to be nowhere, to be here now here, is to be focused and here with that one thing. And the album does that beautifully. And I can't wait for the world to hear it.
I can't either. Just go run out and listen. I think that's it. That's all.
Why are you still listening to
Get out of here.
That's what I'm wondering. So, all right, we'll wrap it up with that. But more great stuff coming. Great to be with you again, my friend.
Yes, same here. Bye.
Bye. See you again soon.